Hello and welcome to the Main Reader on Main Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author had been investigating the groundwater under her yard and had called in a dowser. We resume Suburban Safari on page 64 with episode 7. I mock him that night among a group of friends. My hostess gives me a look, then goes to fetch a handful of pendant necklaces. Just let it hang until it's still, she says, giving each of us a necklace. Now ask it, show me yes. Snickering we do. The silence expands as each pendant begins to swing. Now ask it to show you no, our hostess prompts. We obey. The pendants quiet themselves, then swing in a new direction. I can't explain it, and I won't try. The next morning, curious about how Roland's water lines compare to the underlying geology, I unroll my bedrock map. The bands of color show how the layered bedrock under my yard was folded accordion style. The colored bands run in the same directions as the water veins Roland marked. If Roland is right, my dream of digging a pond for the backyard creatures isn't going to come true. I'd like Cheeky and the gang to have natural, earth-cleaned water, but calling in a well driller seems excessive, even for someone who converses with crows and kisses chipmunks. And even if I did install a cistern to collect rainwater from my roof, this year's harvest wouldn't wet a woodchuck's whistle. By September, groundwater levels across the state will be at a record low. Streams will be running dry. My backyard companions, like me, will have to settle for the cast iron river and all its chemistry. Section 2. Summer. Chapter 4. I love you, now spit out my azalea. Something's up. Three squirrels are sharing one apple tree, and I hear no cussing, see no bloody tails flutter to the ground. Something is wrong here. As I creep close, three gray bodies scramble down various branches and disappear into holes in the trunk. After a moment, two eyes appear in one hole. In another hole, two noses emerge, cheeks pressed together. Eyes rolled my way. The cheeks are a bit chubby. The noses are dark brown. They've got to be youngsters. Whiskers twitch, and the pair ooze in tandem from their hole. They plop onto a branch and gaze at me. The third remains in his low hole, looking sour. His siblings turn to each other for a bit of grooming or playing. It's hard to tell which. One bear hugs the other's head. The huggee slips free and grabs the hugger's tail, running it through his paws and jaws. The tailee twists to hug her sibling around the middle, and the huggee slithers around the hugger until he's the hugger now. The cuteness is immense, and a bit clumsy. In fact, it won't be long before little squirrel bodies litter the streets all over town. Maybe the churlish squirrel, I'll call him Earl, has a premonition of the hard days ahead. He props both elbows on his window sill and settles in for a protracted glare. I'm sensitive to his discomfort, but I can't pull myself away. His siblings are practicing their footwork in the apple tree canopy. As one makes a dash up a flight of parallel branches, her foot misses a grip and she slips. She descends and starts over again. My own pegs are a bit stiff from standing still, and I shift my weight. Everyone dives down a hole again. Soon they're back, clambering through the leaves. Well, not Earl, who's resumed his glaring, but the other two eat leaves, chew bits of bark, and wrestle as though I've vanished. They slip on branches and catch themselves. They jump onto each other's heads. They lie flat as though fatigued and bite hunks of bark off the tree. At the risk of repeating myself, the cuteness is absurd. Even Earl starts to relax, his eyes closing and his head nodding. He rouses himself and retreats. "Chur!" he snarls as he goes. His siblings cock their ears for a minute. Then they're wrestling again. In the coming weeks, the kids will fan out from their tree. They'll hop too slowly across expanses of grass, exposing their spines to predators. They'll dawdle in roads, acquainting themselves with motor vehicles. And flicking their tails in my direction, they'll climb the deck to ogle the tender corners of my house. Already someone is spreeing in the wall at night. It sounds too small to be a squirrel, but that's scant comfort. My personal goal for my personal yard is emerging. I want all native creatures to be welcome here. But my goal hits little obstacles, little furry obstacles that eat my home and pee in my ceiling. Disregard for humanity is a helpful quality in a mammal who aims to thrive in town. Squirrels have buckets of that disregard. They have to focus all their regard on getting through a year alive and with their tail intact. Squirrel life looks carefree at first blush, but I think we may mistake one squirrel for the next and falsely conclude that they're always around and always finding food. From the moment I began watching my squirrels, I saw tragedy and high turnover. Right away I noticed that one animal was missing all but a tuft of tail. Stumpy, I called him. Without the flag of tail following him across the lawn, his gait resembled that of a mini rabbit. I wondered what had happened to him. A birth defect? Not likely. In the definitive squirrel reference, North American tree squirrels, I read that 10% of squirrels have suffered a serious tail-shortening experience, almost always provided by one of their own kind. The males, when chasing a female in heat, tend to run in packs, and the guys in the back distract the guys in the front by snipping off their tails. It didn't take me long to realize I had bestowed the name Stumpy too hastily. I was sitting in the oak tree one day when I heard a rustle in the maple sapling next door. A squirrel was descending into the bamboo wilderness. She was not doing it gracefully. She slipped, scratched, hung by one foot. In jerks and hitches, she clambered onto a fallen log, and there I could see that she was missing most of her tail. She had an inch more than Stumpy, so in my notes I referred to her as Semi-Stumpy. She came toward me. At 10 feet, she spotted me. She froze, and I did too, hoping she'd lose interest. As I watched her watch me, it came to my attention that she wasn't really a Semi-Stumpy at all. She was double Stumpy. She was seriously Stumpy and Stumpy squared. She had no right rear foot. That explains the messy descent. I take back Stumpy's name and give it to this new girl. After freezing for 5 minutes, I hit the limit of my endurance. Things itched. Other things ached. Stumpy had not moved a molecule and showed no discomfort. This freeze response works. Many predators don't pay much attention to stationary objects. I once watched a dog rush around the yard, frenzied by the scent of woodchuck, while that woodchuck sat like a stone, smack in the middle of the lawn. The chuck could have trimmed the dog's toenails, it passed so close. I need to either move or scream, so I talk softly to Stumpy as I shift. She thaws. She turns to face me, revealing a left ear that's missing a V of flesh. She raises her stumpy leg to scratch an itch, but makes no contact. She's calm enough to get back to her chores. Her furry peg leg slips on the wood as she hops along the tree and enters the bamboo wilderness. I hear her climb a sumac, then hear a scratch and a plop as she falls. She proves to be a regular in the yard. Her hop is high and short, and she's often chased by other squirrels. She's nervous and quick to rush for a tree when she hears the alarm call of a blue jay or a crow. But come fall, she'll get the best of her brethren, bouncing away to a new territory with their acorns in her teeth. Few scientists study urban mammals, the woodchucks and possums and chipmunks. These creatures must lack economic and ecological importance. But squirrels are studied. It's not because so many people love or hate squirrels. Rather, squirrels do interesting things. They stash food, then locate it again. The acorns they misplace keep oak trees sprouting. In some ecosystems, squirrels are so enmeshed with the reproduction of pines and oaks that without them, it's possible the ecosystem could collapse. Last, but definitely not least, squirrels are easy to study. They sleep at night, which biologists also prefer to do. And they're so casual around people that much of their behavior can be observed. The result is that biologists are able to study a mammal with more ease and comfort than normal. Under the pressure of scientific inquiry, the squirrel's mind is revealing its secrets. I find the revelations detailed in North American Tree Squirrels, which relates the peculiar behavior of not just squirrels, but also the people who study squirrels. Scholars Mike Steele and John Kaprowski describe squirrel experiments with a sharp eye and a tongue-in-cheek. Consider the mystery of squirrels' resource management. When presented with acorns from red oak trees and white oak trees, squirrels do different things with each. Why? Squirrelologists inquired. And how do they tell the acorns apart? Enter the other nutsmiths, Steele, Kaprowski, and other researchers who tamper with acorns to test squirrels. The first task is to confirm that squirrels do treat red and white acorns differently. Steele and Kaprowski fix tiny metal tags to both kinds of acorns and give them to squirrels. The squirrels eat some, and they bury some. The nutsmithies fire up a metal detector and retrieve the buried acorns. Conclusion: squirrels eat the white oak acorns and bury the reds for winter. Why? The researchers are confident they know. White oak acorns germinate the same autumn that they drop from the tree. Burying them would be a waste of squirrel time, because they'd promptly sprout. Red oak acorns, however, don't germinate until the following year. They're ideal for storing. Squirrels have evolved an instinct to store acorns that have a long shelf life. So, how do they know the difference? Researchers doubt that squirrels simply eyeball their acorns. First of all, the rodents' wide-set eyes aren't suited for close work. Second, when a squirrel grasps an acorn in his paws, he rolls it under his nose rather than peering at it. So the scholars tackled the smell issue. It took 3 research seasons to build the perfect experimental acorn, or fakorn. The shell had to be sliced clean in half, the cotyledon taken out and ground to powder, then the shells restuffed with a custom nut meat mixed from ground cotyledon and various additives. The investigators put red acorn meat in white shells, white acorn meat in red shells, and even adjusted the ratio of bitter tannin to yummy fat in their fakorns. To remove any chemical clues from the shells, they soaked them in acetone. Then they glued the shells shut with odorless adhesive. The squirrels were stumped. They couldn't tell the difference between fakorns stuffed with red meat and those stuffed with white. Only when researchers omitted the shell-soaking stage did squirrels respond. In that case, they buried any kind of fakorn that was presented in a red oak shell. They ate any fakorn in a white oak shell. So the smell of a red oak shell cues a squirrel to bury, right? Wrong. The final round of this investigation asked whether the squirrels could detect if an acorn was preparing to sprout. And they can. When researchers handed squirrels two red oak acorns, one dormant, the other winter primed for germination, squirrels nipped the embryo out of the reds that were preparing to sprout, then buried them. The scholars had seen this before. If a squirrel is given only white oak acorns, he will bite out the embryo that causes the acorn to sprout and bury the sterilized nut. Scientists had just never seen it done with red oak acorns. So, eureka! By sniffing the shell of any acorn, squirrels can smell fertility, and they nip it in the bud. I must say, biting out the embryo from a seed is one of those behaviors that gives me pause. When a squirrel bites out the tip of an acorn, he is not thinking back to what he learned about germination in his botany class. He's relying on a knee-jerk instinct, which some distant ancestor got by way of a genetic mutation. The bite-out-the-embryo instinct caused such success in that ancestor's family that his descendants thrived to the exclusion of all their relatives. The delicacy, the freakish precision, of evolution sometimes floors me. Another excellent question is how squirrels recover their stashed acorns. As soon as the red oak in my backyard began dropping acorns in late summer, the squirrels were spiriting them away. Actually, they began harvesting acorns the moment they swelled into existence. In late June, squirrels young and old were thrashing around in the canopy, pruning and dropping entire twigs in their quest for baby acorns. As the acorns grew fat, squirrels harvested them directly, carrying them down the trunk and into the bushes. By the time nuts were pelting like hail on the shed roof, the squirrels were in a burying delirium. They might carry an acorn just a few feet before digging the quickest hole, tamping the earth, and pawing the grass straight. The crows do the same thing when there's a lot of food lying around. Their first priority is to get the goods out of sight. After that, they can move it around at leisure. As the hail of acorns diminished, the squirrels shifted their attention to cache management. This was an endless task. I watched my squirrels psych each other out by pretending to bury the same acorn in three different places. Where the nut ends up, only the burier knows. In addition to handling their own nuts, I see my squirrels trail the crows and blue jays, nosing under leaves and pawing aside grass to see if the birds stored anything worth stealing. Many times I watched Stumpy stealth walking into my yard from the north neighbor's yard. She would cross my lawn and creep into the bamboo wilderness. A few minutes later, she would emerge, acorn in mouth, and run for home. Sometimes the injured party discovered her and gave chase with much clattering of teeth. But time after time, Stumpy sprinted home with the prize. How do squirrels find buried food? From what researchers can deduce, memory and odor both play a role. Squirrels can find nuts they've buried after fakehorn makers deodorize them, which implicates memory. And they can also find nuts their neighbors buried, which implicates smell. As to their overall efficiency at finding what they've hidden, studies are few, but the tree squirrel's authors say it can reach 95%. The more I learn about my squirrels, the more I'm mortified by the dangers they face, and the dangers become clear. Soon after my young cuties pop out of their apple tree, young cuties appear all over town, flattened. Some have been hit by cars. Some may have been chased into traffic by dogs or cats. Others probably fell from trees, which happens more often than I would have thought. Steele and Kaprowski report that nearly 1 in 20 gray squirrels harbors a healed fracture in one leg or another. The flattened squirrels re-enter the food chain, at least. In my neighborhood, Crows, perhaps chuckling at the memory of squirrels swatting them, tug off strips of red flesh and store them in the trees. In spite of what looks like an epidemic of street fatalities, starvation seems to be the most common cause of squirrel mortality. The details give me a new admiration for the mother that brought up my three cuties. Last summer and fall, she stashed and stashed, ate and ate, putting on fat. As the air grew colder, she grew less choosy. Instead of eating the mild tops off acorns, she chewed each nut to its bitter end. The early darkness sent her up to her dray, a hollow sphere of leaves she shared with her female kin. Winter struck, and still she went out to feed, digging through snow and frozen soil to recover a meal. In January she mated, and 44 days later lost 1/10 of her body weight in the form of pink progeny. Her fatty milk depended on more acorns, and out she went to extract them. As the snow piled up in my yard, I noticed that my squirrels spent a lot of their excavating time in wind cups that formed in the lee of trees. I wonder if they bury more acorns in these spots, or if these were the only places they could hope to dig to the ground. The three kids developed a taste for solid food just as spring brought out the new leaves and flower buds. They had survived. If a late frost had killed this first round of leaves, that might have been the end. Instead, it looks like the end for my neighbor's old apple tree that hosts the adorable brats. The squirrel babies have eaten the bejesus out of it, and they're ready for something new. With their brown velvet noses testing the air, they stealth walk toward my home. Hang on. Now that I think back, Mom Squirrel didn't face much hardship at all when she was nursing her brood. She had my bird seed to fall back on. For the umpteenth time, I had hung a bird feeder full of sunflower seed. For the umpteenth time, squirrels had giggled in their sleeves, shinnied up the middle pole, and emptied the feeder. I apologized to my wallet and slapped down $20 for a tubular metal baffle that slid over the pole. Oh, it was gratifying to watch a squirrel shinny up the pole and halt with her head under the baffle. Hee-hee! The 3 days it took for them to crack this particular nut were delightful for me, but in retrospect, not worth $20. On day 4, one determined squirrel leaped straight up past the tube and caught the perch rail of the feeder. I moved the feeder up 4 inches to the highest part of the pole. This bought me 1 hour. I expect if I could raise the feeder an inch a day, I'd eventually have a squirrel who could medal in an Olympic jumping event. So I gave up. The truth is, I felt sorry for the animal anyway, knowing it could be a nursing mother whose cupboard held only sour old acorns. I took to throwing sunflower seeds on the warming ground. This produced some rousing fights. Whichever squirrel was eating first seemed to have the right to throw the others out, and he who was evicted was often so incensed that woe betide the spring blossom who might witness his humiliation. One frustrated fellow barreled over to a tulip and bit its stalk in half. Another day, a loser ran to a daffodil, pulled its head to the ground, and slashed its belly with his hind feet. They were gory times, but as summer unfolded, maple seeds fell, acorns swelled, and the tension dissipated. Considering my generosity, I grow tired of the squirrels' distrust of me. I feed them and talk to them, but they treat me like a serial killer. When I step outside, they race for the safety of the trees, their tails flailing. The crows, whom I've been talking to and feeding for months now, are just as bad. They'll tolerate me sitting on the deck, but they still scatter if I look at them. Geez. Obviously, these critters are lousy judges of character, but it still makes me feel bad. The companionship of Cheeky the chipmunk is all the more gratifying in light of the blood-curdling effect I have on the crows and squirrels. While the squirrels flick their tails on a high branch, Cheeky sits in my palm. I rub behind his ears and run his copper tail through my fingers. I poke his cheek and hear the seeds shift inside. I rub my thumb over his face and he shuts an eye. Only when I close my thumb and forefinger on either side of his distended cheeks does he react. He rears back and looks up at my face as though he's never met anyone so rude. Then he resumes shoveling in the sunflower seeds. Why do I yearn for the affection of the animals in my yard? Maybe the price of being the top dog species is that we scare everyone else and then feel isolated. Maybe this cross-species ardor is a side effect of being a community-minded animal with a complicated brain. Who knows? Beyond dispute is that people crave animal companionship, and by a country mile, the favored companions are mammals. My biophilia even extends to woodchucks, now that I'm not trying to grow vegetables. At my previous house, the wretches trundled from beneath the shed at dawn and mowed my peas to the ground day after day. I hardened my heart against them and loosed my hound, a dog who has since passed on. From time to time, I would be rewarded with a fresh corpse, buried in the flower bed. One day I watched the hound stand on his side of the fence and snap the necks of four baby chucks who ambled one after the next out of the neighbor's tall grass and between the pickets. What a glorious scene! When the neighbor girl caught on and wailed, I sternly ordered my dog indoors where I fed him hamburger. But at this new house, I look forward to seeing Big Fat Mama chug out of the bushes. She must weigh 10 or 12 pounds, and when she props herself on her butt to scout for danger, her fat and fur drape her like royalty. She selects broad leaves from my weedy lawn, and I watch them waggle in her jaws. She, like Cheeky, tolerates me talking to her. She maintains a network of escape holes, and if I should become impertinent, she knows where the nearest one is. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn, by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.